Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 372nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia, and coming to you directly from downtown Toronto.
Mike Allen. It's not downtown, but Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta, and presently located. I've been removed from Alberta for a 30-day period.
Yes.
Not quite, but yeah, I'm presently in Toronto. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're going through our different question and answers.
Exactly. James, so why don't we just jump right into the questions, and this one comes from Sean, and he's a healthcare provider, and it starts off, it says James, because, you know, they always send me this stuff because that's, you know,
the best thing. Yeah, they know the nice guy.
Yeah, exactly. He said, I had quite the conversation with my lipid specialist. I have familial hypercholesterolemia, and I'm on maximum statins, and I got my LDL to around 5.5, and I'm very healthy otherwise, and he wishes to put me on one of the new PKSK9s, Sean just wants to wait. And one of those medications, we've talked about these medications before, one of them is evolocumab. And he says, where the conversation got interesting is he said, you must get your cholesterol below 2, and it doesn't matter how you get there. And when I questioned the lack of good hard outcomes with any other drug other than a statin, he said, nonsense. That it only matters getting LDL down. It does not matter what drugs you use to get there. And he also made a statement that the Fourier trial, which was the evolocumab, would have been a blockbuster trial if the patients were not already on a statin. And the only reason that the results were modest was because their cholesterols were already low. And he says, we agreed to disagree, and he agreed to return me back to my GP, as I guess I'm too much of a troublemaker for him. So there's some really interesting parts to this entire question. First of all, it's always interesting to see that, you know, you can imagine where patients sometimes fit in. It is not uncommon that one healthcare provider who's taking care of another healthcare provider, where you get into debates and questions. This is not just patients that get into it. It's very tricky sometimes for a healthcare provider to deal with these issues when it's their own care.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's hard not to take a... It's hard to sit in the back seat, like I guess we expect a lot of patients to do.
Yeah.
And certainly if you want even shared informed decision making, many physicians will take it far beyond that and advocate for what specifically they want and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And so I don't know how we'll just talk a little bit about a few things. And here's where the issue is. And if you've listened to any of the podcasts over the last 10 years, you will know that there is no doubt there are people who are very, very LDL or cholesterol focused, and those of us, including myself, who are not so focused on that number. There have been many, many studies showing that not every drug that lowers cholesterol or lowers LDL or raises HDL improves outcome. So the Fourier trial, which was a drug which looked at patients who were already on a statin, who already had a relatively low LDL, when they gave him this new evolocumab, which is, I think you'd agree with me, Mike, is probably has the best ability to lower LDL.
Yes, it does, as far as I know.
Yeah, and it did show a benefit, and it was, I think, about a 15% relative benefit, if I remember correctly.
It is,
in reducing cardiovascular outcomes, which is in contrast to what we see typically with statins, which is around 25%. Depending on dose, maybe upwards of 30%, but around that number. And so the lipid specialist may be correct. The problem is we have no idea if they are correct. I mean, it is possible. But, you know, in theory, this drug did lower LDL by an impressive percentage. So you wonder why it didn't have as big a benefit. So there really is no answer. And you know what, Mike? What do you think the chances are that we'll ever see an evolocumab statin comparison trial?
Low. You were less hopeful than I was, but I would go low.
Yeah, almost non-existent.
It won't happen. It won't happen, actually, because you can't. The only group that you could put on evolocumab or similar PCSK9 drug without statins are patients who are report complete intolerance to statins.
Yeah.
And then in those trials, you have to be very careful about re-randomizing, even though many of those would still be tolerant to statins if retried. There's research on that as well.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I don't think we'll see it. It's almost unethical to say to a patient who would be eligible for a statin to not get a statin. So it's going to be very tricky. The arguments abound here. So you can argue that it wasn't sure PCSK9s reduce a percent of cholesterol really well. But what the cholesterol people believe in is a millimole reduction. So instead of just the percent of cholesterol coming down, they want to see a certain change in millimoles of cholesterol. And when you were already at two or I'm not quite sure what that would be in the U.S. units, but low, you can't really get, I think that'd be around 160 or something. You can't, it's hard to get down that next level because you're starting so much lower.
Yeah, but you do, I don't know if you remember, but that change per millimole, I think I'm correct in this. That is a change. About 10 years ago, there were some, the cholesterol, whatever that group is that does all of these meta-analysis came out.
Cholesterol trialists.
Yeah. Yes, and they presented, it's all about the per millimole. It, before that time, it used to be the, how much of a clinical, for every 1% reduction in cholesterol, you get a 1% benefit. That used to be the mantra.
Yeah, no, so you're saying that that they're just changing based on their, when it doesn't turn out for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't think anyone ever does that, James.
Oh, Mike, have you listened to any of the podcasts we've done?
The other thing about this that's, you know, these people were getting down to very low. There's no doubt about it. Mm. But what was interesting in the clinical trial is they actually looked at attained LDL versus and did a correlation to the effect that patients got. And they found that the attained LDL did not correlate with the improvements clinically.
Yeah.
So in other words, if you got to 0.5 LDL, which I guess would be around 40 or something, versus if you got to 2, which would be somewhere around 160, it didn't change whether you got benefit. It was more, it seemed to be whether you had taken the drug.
Right.
And it definitely improved your cholesterol, but the actual target that you got to, because that would depend a huge amount on where you started.
Yeah.
It turns out that didn't really have an impact.
Yeah. And I think, and I just want to, I'm pretty sure, I'm going to go back and check this, but I think 1 is 40, 2 is 80.
Oh, is it? Okay, so I got it wrong then. With half whatever I just said.
Yeah, basically. So I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure that, and I'll, before we post this podcast, I'll check it. I'm pretty sure 40 is equivalent to 1 and 80 is equivalent to 2. So when we're talking about getting people to 2, we're talking about getting them below 80. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
that might be it. I was trying to remember that 80 jumped to my mind, but I don't quite know why.
Yeah. and I could be completely wrong, but I promise you, if what I said is wrong, we'll tweak the podcast. Or we just complain about the Americans, get them to change these SI units. Anyway, enough of that. So the next question is from a guy named Mike. And I know so many of these people, but anyway, he says, I'm an emergency physician, but I like to pretend I'm smart enough to still practice family medicine, and the Best Science Medicine podcast is a great tool to keep up in primary care therapeutics. And says, I really enjoy the podcast and have enjoyed several of your courses as well. So I love it. And just wanted to comment on the last podcast about the value of screening. So that was a while ago, but that's okay. On getting CBCs. And he says that one thing I would put to you is that a screening CBC can often have value down the road as establishing a baseline. And because, Mike, you are the self-proclaimed expert in this, I sent this email to you to sort of comment on that. And Mike gave a few examples where a screening CBC could definitely affect his management and so on. And I think you then responded to him.
Yeah, so this is always kind of the clinical mantra, like, and it makes sense. So let's say I have a patient in my practice who is diabetic and seems to be doing a little bit worse. I'm not quite sure what it is. He's not sure what it is, or she's not sure what it is. And we do an ECG, and sure enough, there are changes now in mm-hmm. their ECG, which could have related to an MI that was silent. So then I look, there's no old ECG to know. And this is one of those times where you think, darn, if I just had an old ECG, I'd know.
Yeah.
And that's true. Absolutely, yeah. It is true. The only trouble is that baseline ECG, we don't have evidence that it works. We do have research showing that they are likely to lead to problems. Mm-hmm. We just did you're absolutely doing fine. We did your ECG. It's kind of equivocal. We're going to repeat it. Oh, it's not quite clear. And I'm going to do an echo. Something maybe seen on the echo, or maybe your ejection fraction isn't quite what I think it should be, or what have you. So now off to the cardiologist, and off you go to the stress test, and then on to an angiogram, and yeah, we kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it sounds absolutely ridiculous, but those are the trouble is we can cause harms with our investigation. And one of them is just the going on for more and more. The improbable event of something serious, like I just indicated, is really low, but we don't have evidence that they're helpful. We do have evidence that regular screening ones are not helpful and probably harmful. So there is no right answer here. I generally don't do this. The example given was around a CBC, and that some patients have different types of, like, alpha thalassemia minor, which can be really difficult to sort out when you're dealing with minor anemia, and it does take some time. I admit that you're ordering a lot of other tests that if you had a baseline, but these patients would have needed, if you ordered a baseline in them and you picked up the alpha thalassemia, you picked up something abnormal, you'd have to order that cascade of tests anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that it's absolutely wrong. I'm just saying that the best evidence we have now does not indicate that they're helpful.
Yeah. And then to get the, you might have this one patient for which it would be useful to have that baseline, but to get that, you have to have maybe tens or hundreds of baselines, and mm-hmm. then you run into all of the problems with all those false positives.
Yeah, I know. It's and like I said, you're like, the workups are going to occur at one point. If you order a test and identify someone as an alpha thalassemia or a potential anemia, and then you have to work it up to find whether it's alpha thalassemia or whether it's anemia of chronic disease, or whether it's a true iron deficiency anemia, all of those are going to require that same gamut of tests.
Yeah.
The ferritin and it's not perfect. There's no doubt about it.
And it's, these things are very tricky, and it's really unusual to be, just completely black and white.
Oh yeah. And in this zone, we can't, I think you can be black and white in saying everyone does not need a yearly ECG or a yearly CBC, but the whole baseline argument becomes tricky.
Yeah.
And CBC, I say ECG is the trickier one to me. CBC is the one that it's really, because to me, if I order a CBC in a 35-year-old as a baseline, how is that going to help me when they're 50?
Yeah.
The chances that it would have been stable over that time frame are pretty low, but who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. So the next one is from David, and he says, I enjoy the podcasts. Among my favorites were the ones on the most useful medicines. And along a similar line, could you put together a list of treatments that have an NNT of less than 10? Because he says, surely there must be medications that work more than just 10% of the time. But he was having trouble finding that sort of stuff. And so what I did is I sent back to him, here's just a list of a bunch of medications that we typically use and some of the NNTs. And I'll sort of work you just through some of them just for fun. So if you really want medications that have an NNT of 1, I think the two main ones that come to mind are general anesthesia and local anesthetics. Would you agree with that sort of, Mike?
Yes, although sometimes it takes more.
Yeah.
So as long as you don't put a dose restriction on it,
exactly.
The answer is yes.
Yeah. So, and there are always going to be a very small percentage of people who may not respond to those, but that would be a numbers needed to treat as close as we could get to one. Now, if we go up to numbers needed to treat of two, there are two medications, and just a caveat, these are both used for different things. The two sort of examples are proton pump inhibitors for heartburn and sildenafil for successful intercourse. And I do not want to get into a discussion about what is successful intercourse. But the absolute...
I appreciate that.
Pardon me?
I appreciate that.
Yes, yes, I thought you would, because I knew you were just about to draw a picture. So
for a podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. So so what a number needed to treat means is that there is a 50% absolute benefit over placebo. And that's what we see with proton pump inhibitors. And it's why so many people are on them. Well, there's other reasons, but is that they are exceedingly effective.
And they like them. Yeah. And they like them.
Yeah. For heartburn. And so the key is to get to the lowest effective dose that will work, because And the same thing applies to sildenafil, is that, you know, there's pretty good evidence that 100 milligrams is just as good as 50 and just as good as 25. And that's from RCTs. And so there's a couple of drugs that have an NNT of 2. NSAIDs and opioids for pain, depending on where you look, may have an NNT of around 3 to 5. Again, very much depends on the type of pain and the degree of pain. Steroids for sore throat, the numbers needed to treat are around 3, again depending on what studies you look at and so on, but so that's a reasonable benefit. I don't know if you want to mention Bell's palsy, the numbers needed to treat for steroids is around 10, Mike?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Antibiotics for acute COPD exacerbations, the numbers needed to treat are around 5, so that's a 20% absolute benefit. A few other examples that I came up with: topical antibiotics for bacterial conjunctivitis, the numbers needed to treat are 7, which I bet some people would be surprised. I bet many people would think, oh, isn't the numbers needed to treat 1? Because when you give topical antibiotics, they get better. That's why we do placebo controls trials.
Yeah.
Sure. And then there's a bit of a debate about what the number needed to treat is for antidepressants. If you look overall, the numbers needed to treat are around 10. In other words, about 10% improvement above placebo. But I think you'd agree, Mike, it probably depends somewhat on the severity of the depression.
Yeah, so that's one that we really have some good evidence around, mm-hmm. that the severity of the depression drives the effect, because the placebo effect is relatively stable. Drug effect is relatively stable. The placebo effect declines as the severity of depression. So it starts out at a 10 to 12 or even higher for mild depression. Moderate is kind of a 10, 8, and then it goes to as good and very severe depression. Drugs have an NNT as good in some studies as 6.
Yeah, but that still means that when you, even in the most severely depressed people, if you give them an antidepressant and they get better, it's still unlikely to be the drug.
I thought you were going to try and be positive on the...
I'm positive about that comment that I just made. what about, so there are, as many people know, the typical treatment of choice for an acute asthma attack is obviously inhaled salbutamol, but there are studies that have looked at taking, especially in the pediatric population, using not only salbutamol, but also an anticholinergic, and so ipratropium, is when it's added in for an asthma attack, you get a numbers needed to treat of around 11 for hospitalization. So if you're in an emergency department, the numbers needed to treat for adding in ipratropium is about, let's say, 10, around 10%. We've done these drugs a lot on the podcast, talking about the cholinesterase inhibitors, Mike. To see a change in the ADAS-COG score of greater than 4, which is most people consider a minimally important change or difference.
Yeah.
We're talking about numbers needed to treat of around 10. So about 10% of more people get that change than they do if they're on placebo. But then about that equal number get side effects.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And then...
The side effects that are bad enough to make them want to stop.
Yeah. So not just a little bit of diarrhea.
Yeah.
Enough that they want to stop it.
Or what have you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then... sleeping pills. I thought this would be a useful one. When you don't look at time of falling asleep and how long you stay asleep and all sorts of things. There are some studies that have looked at the actual percentage of people who get an improvement in sleep quality with sleeping pills, and the numbers needed to treat are around 13. So those are just some examples, not all of those.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, years ago, someone mentioned that evidence-based medicine always seems to be very nihilistic. So I created this talk called Happy News from a So-Called Nihilist.
Mm.
And I'll just quickly go over some of those.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, go ahead.
So for very high blood pressure, which we often talk about treating 145, but if you're talking about 187 over 121, mm-hmm. and giving up to three drugs at 18 and a half months or so, 5% of people in placebo die versus zero in treatment. Mm-hmm. And if you look at any kind of cardiovascular vascular event, it's 39% versus three. So a number needed to treat of three,
yeah,
for that. So that's for exceptionally high blood pressure.
And but we do need to remember that was the treatment of what at the time was typically called malignant hypertension. And,
right.
You know, fortunately we don't see those people anymore because, you know, we do have people who do check people's blood pressure and it's most people don't get to those numbers, although you still see a few.
You do. You still see some in the 190,
yeah.
120 range, which was around where this was.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll skip through to heart failure. The number needed to treat for heart failure is somewhere in the kind of 14 to 18 for aldosterone antagonist, beta blockers, mm-hmm. and ACE inhibitors over. These are people who are quite sick, but still. If you look at warfarin over 5 years, the number needed to treat is somewhere in the 2-3 range for the people with really high CHAD scores, like mm-hmm. fives and sixes. For infections, things like cystitis has a number needed to treat of 2-3 for antibiotics. Mm-hmm. The drainage of abscesses, we don't have clinical trials where they didn't drain an abscess, as you can imagine. But when you do, that 86% of people are better in 10 days. For tinea pedis, something as simple as giving topical treatments have a 70% resolution for the average cases. Corticosteroids for... asthma exacerbations in a short-term course are a number needed to treat of 10 for 7 days for relapse. For steroids, injections in the knee, a number needed to treat of kind of 2-4, and the benefits there are something like 75 versus 45 for a placebo at 2 weeks. And we could go on about those.
Oh yeah, I mean, all you have to do is, you know, drugs that, you know, and maybe even a couple of other drugs that maybe have an NNT of one would be salbutamol. For a person, yeah. who's short of breath, it helps almost all of them.
Yeah, it really, like, and that one, of course, it's so hard to get an NNT of
yeah.
one because you need 100% versus zero, but
yeah.
It would be darn close to that.
Yeah,
yeah.
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 So, you know, there's
NNT
a lot
of six. I was going to say this one because I love this one. NNT of six for riding a bicycle versus angioplasty.
Yeah, yeah.
For preventing a vascular outcome.
Yeah.
So there's a lot out there that we have big impacts for.
Mm-hmm.
And even things like TCAs and gabapentin for neuropathic pain, they're not perfect, but they're often having NNT somewhere in the range of 4-8 kind of thing. So mm-hmm.
yeah.
There's a lot of interventions that do work to some extent. So I think we have to celebrate that, James. Celebrate it.
Yeah. Woohoo! was that enough?
That was more than enough. That
I know.
Was more than I'm comfortable with.
So we'll do one more. And this
yeah.
is from Robert, who says, "Dear James and Mike, again, got the name order correct. Thank you so much for doing the podcast on spinal manipulation for low back pain. I am an osteopathic physician, board certified in family medicine by the AAFP and the ACOFP. I currently practice as a hospitalist, but formerly performed a lot of spinal manipulation and so on. And in medical school, I was always irritated by the lack of good evidence regarding spinal manipulation. And it's what we call osteopathic manipulative treatment, or OMT, and especially around the cult of the followers. Your podcast was excellent. I know it's difficult to research this area, but he wanted to just emphasize the difference between chiropractors and osteopaths. And I'm not going to get into that debate, but they have different training. And anyway, he sent in a few links looking at only at osteopathic providers. And again, there's a lot of problem with the evidence. And
yeah.
And we emailed him back saying, yeah, we in fact know a couple of colleagues who are osteopaths, and I think we know the difference between all that. And you know, every healthcare provider has a use in my mind. There is none that really can't provide benefit, and it's just all working within your you know, your scope of practice, in my opinion, because a lot of what we do in, you know, in allopathic medicine doesn't work as well as what people think. So, but anyway, you responded to him about some of the issues associated with it. And I think one of the comments you made was that my response to him was very, very accurate.
I said, I'd like to say that James wrote was accurate. I'd like to say that.
Yes. Anyway, so you're gonna say something about a tools for practice that you guys did of the
Tools for practice on this, and it did generate a little bit of heat, not a lot, but a little bit, some frustration, the fact that the evidence is so poor. There is some research around different providers and maybe being better. So what this person brought up is that osteopaths may be better. There is some research to support that. The challenge is the quality of the research is so low that it's very hard to tell a lot of the time. And one of the challenges that I want people to kind of understand, and I don't have this exactly right because I don't have one of the studies in front of me, but they had a sameness about them. And we did talk about it in the podcast, but on the Tools for Practice. But you can imagine if in one arm of a clinical trial, what I did is I gave people spinal manipulation therapy. I also gave them codeine, 30 milligrams up to QID for 10 days. And I also gave them a pamphlet on back health. In the other arm, I sent them to a physiotherapist who was not allowed to perform spinal manipulation. I gave them naproxen 250, 1 to 2 tabs BID for 10 days. And I gave them a exercise ball. Then I tried to compare those two groups and say that chiropractic care was better. Then you can see where that might get a little cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the exact example I gave probably doesn't occur, but there are all sorts of the arms of each trial generally had more than one intervention, and the interventions virtually never overlapped or rarely overlap. And so you end up comparing apples to oranges each time, and it just became so clouded and difficult to interpret.
It is very difficult. Yeah, but no, yeah, it's. But anyway, we'll put a link to that Tools for Practice so people can have a look at that.
Yeah,
And then there was a PS just at the end of his podcast where it says, "Thanks again so much for doing the podcast. It's actually a major reason why I started my own completely non-evidence-based medicine podcast based off of interesting cases that I've seen." He says, "You guys rock." I love that because Mike, I can tell you, I can think of probably at least 3 or 4, maybe even 5 podcasts that people have said they've decided to do their own podcast because they've heard us doing this podcast. Now, you can take that 2 ways.
I was going to say that there's a way you're going to take it, which is positive. And the way I read it is they can do it, anybody
can do it. And what they're doing is so awful. We need to counterbalance. But no, there's a number of people who, some people say, well, do you care about the competition? Absolutely. I couldn't tell you how little I care about it. It's all about getting good information out there. And Mike, you and I think we can both say that our experience of doing this podcast and the positive feedback that we get and all the people who listen it's been one of the greater educational experiences of my career. And if anyone out there gets the opportunity to experience that, I would love it if they did it. And in fact, if you are thinking of doing a podcast and you want some help and suggestions and advice as to how to set it up, how to do the recordings and all that sort of stuff, feel free to drop me a line and I'll do my best to at least let you know what we do. And then you can go ahead and do the exact opposite.
Yeah, because there's, it is good actually. I don't mind the competition.
No.
And you know, we were lucky. We got in at a time where early. Podcasts were just starting to grow.
Yeah.
And you were smart enough to tell me, to be quiet and to just do the podcast because yes. I said this will never work. Yeah. And for more of my wisdom, stay tuned.
Yeah, exactly. I think we'll leave it at that. We've got a few more questions. Maybe that'll be the next podcast. We'll see what we can fit in. So as I've always mentioned, please send us your questions. And again, if I don't answer it, it is not, don't ever take it personally. Just actually just resend it to me and I will do my best to have a look at it or pass it on to Mike. Our Best Science Medicine course is coming up in Vancouver, May 4th and May 5th. It's all out there. You can sign up for it now. The brochure is all there. You can see who's attending and not attending and all that sort of stuff. So go to our website and check that out. Check out Tools for Practice. And I think that's about it. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.